Preface. The shop directly opposite my childhood home was a small newspaper shop, but all the neighbourhood children called it the sweet shop. The counter was covered with a variety of national and local newspapers, but behind the counter were stacked rows of bottles and jars filled with the sweets we loved, and which we were given as treats or bought with our spare pennies. As much, that is, as the ration books in the 1940s and 1950s allowed. For most of the time, however, we could only look at the jars enviously. Money and rations were in short supply. 50 yards away up the street, there was another sweet shop in a small dowdy bungalow which sold nothing but sweets and chocolates. As if that were not enough, we could stride back across the street to the local co-op, with its own enticing offerings of chocolates and sweets, and biscuits and cakes as well. Even in those straitened times, all this seemed a cornucopia of sweet things, and all within a mere 100 yards of our front door. We all had a sweet tooth, and the constraints of wartime and post-war rationing only made the craving worse. Sometimes we bartered one rationed item for another, swapping life's essentials for a sweet pleasure. Our mother once exchanged our bacon ration for our grandparents' sweets ration. This addiction to sweets and chocolates wasn't just a family matter, but was deeply entrenched in the whole community. All my childhood friends and their families were equally addicted. On high days and holidays, birthdays, Christmas, and Whitsuntide, a major event in Manchester, children were treated to special gifts of chocolates and sweets. Even on our summer seaside holidays, that annual Lancastrian trek from the cotton towns to the Irish Sea, one seaside treat was tackling lengths of that sticky, tooth-defying, sugar-filled Blackpool Rock. Predictably, when sweet rationing finally ended in 1953, the local shops were swiftly cleaned out of the sweet temptations we had all looked forward to. My brother and I managed to get our hands on a small box of Cadbury's milk tray. Our love of sugary treats was only one example of the role sugar played in our lives. In fact, sugar was everywhere. It held pride of place alongside the teapot on the kitchen table that served as a gathering point, not merely for meals, but as a rendezvous for the gaggles of women who trooped in and out of the house throughout the day. Daily social life was lubricated by regular servings of sweet tea. My grandpa could have rivaled Dr. Johnson in his love of strong tea. He always had a half-pint mug of strong tea to hand, and it too was sweetened with lashings of sugar, scooped from the bag that lived permanently on the table in the room that served as kitchen, dining, and sitting room. My mother and her women friends, like the nation at large, moaned endlessly about shortages, but especially about the scarcity of sugar. Although what they were allowed now seems lavish in retrospect, far, far more than my own family would use in the course of a week. But at that time, from 1942 to 1953, sugar was added to everything. It even accompanied us to school. We were dispatched to primary school with a snack for the morning break, slices of toast or bread glued together with heavily sweetened jam, or simply sprinkled with sugar. All this took place in a society that was severely rationed, and we all ticked along in pinched conditions, making do as best we could. Yet, throughout, sugar was everywhere. It was, like tobacco smoke, an inescapable fact of life, and so integral to the way we all lived that we did not even notice it, except, that is, when we ran short. We were also regular visitors to the local dentist, not for regular checkups, but to remove the damage wrought by our sugary diet. All my older relatives had dentures. My father had all his teeth removed at the age of 21. My mother lost her remaining teeth in her mid-30s. Grandma, uncles,